Listeners of last week's show will know that Not Enough Champagne is now being brought to you from our nuclear bunker downtown in suburban Birmingham. It's well stocked with wine, it's well stocked with tinned food, and in homage to our new orange overlords, we're thinking of painting it gold and putting a huge sign on it which says Haynes. Now, that name is obviously in honour of my partner in propaganda, Steve Haynes. Hello, Steve.
Hi, Corey.
I'm also joined by another special guest, Danielle. Hello, Danielle.
Hello, Corey.
4 years ago, had a US election podcast. I think this episode is more sober, not in terms of the alcohol intake, because 4 years ago we thought that it would be a disaster if Mitt Romney was elected president, and now we're praying to God that he's Secretary of State.
This about sums it up.
Actually, you were in America on election day, weren't you?
I was indeed, yep, and I can tell you that the atmosphere the day after was indeed funereal. It was quite amazing, actually, because I was staying with friends. We were all getting ready to party and watching an increasing state of disbelief, a bit of denial as well, and saying, no, the state will hold up. And eventually we're like, no, she's maxed out her vote, as we watched the counties come in and just starting to accept the unimaginable.
And now, in the nuclear bunker in which we're recording, we have carved in marble our schedule for this second series, and the theme of this episode was going to be realignment. We're going to talk about realignment of the left, and we'll be talking a bit about a progressive alliance, which we've seen a few Labour figures talk about. But after another pretty momentous week in politics, I mean, the autumn statement is next week, and I'm pretty sure we're not going to talk about that at all on this podcast. But instead, we're going to talk more about the realignment of reality, a bit like Donald Trump with his auto cue. We're going to stick loosely to the script while lashing wildly out at civilization. Are you feeling anger? Are you feeling denial? I think I'm still really experiencing all five stages of grief at once. There's been a few things talking about how we shouldn't normalise Trump, about how we should be angry, about how we can't just accept that what's happening is normal, we can't rationalise it away. Should we be trying to normalise this? Should we be trying to look for the rational kind of centre of this?
I think it really depends on what you mean by normalise. I think that word's been thrown around a lot, and it's got a couple of different meanings. A lot of people are kind of using it to say, oh yeah, we shouldn't kowtow to the racism, to the misogyny, and all of that sort of stuff. And that's absolutely correct. You absolutely shouldn't. But normalisation also means kind of just getting on with it and doing the job of actually, you know, holding things to account and properly. And certainly in the case of the US media, they do need to get back to a normalisation process where they are actually holding the office of the president to account, as opposed to covering all of his press conferences with at the drop of a hat. A lot of postmortems which are happening in the US media at the moment are kind of acknowledging that they managed to miss a load of things, that they either ignored large aspects of the United States, so in those Midwest counties which swung it for Trump, they just completely ignored them for the most part. So that's why they were suddenly shocked by it all. Or they've just admitted that maybe we shouldn't have been at Trump's beck and call as much. Maybe we did have a role in that.
Well, so the what seems to be a manufactured outrage this week is the fact that Trump went for a steak without telling the media. Isn't that just a case of get over yourselves?
Not really, because we're not talking about, he's not just a candidate for office anymore. He, at the time that happened, he is now the president-elect, and it is pretty much vital for the American public to know where their current president or future leader is at all times. So there could come a point where there's a moment of crisis for America and nobody knows where their president is,
yeah.
which is not good to say the least.
So is that the important thing then? It's not that he can't go off and have a steak, it's more that if the shit goes down, we need to know where he is.
Yeah. Pretty much,
that's
yeah.
exactly it. I mean, after 9/11, George Bush wanted to quite rightly just get the Dodge out of Texas or wherever it was he was, and get back to the Capitol as quickly as possible. He basically got told by a number of his aides, we need to get the press pool going and move them along with us, which is obviously going to take half an hour to an hour. And he was just like, why? Why the hell do we need to do this? And somebody pointed out to him, because if you're up in the air and no one can find you, all kinds of rumours are going to kick off. Everybody is going to start talking, where is the president? And if they don't know where you are, then it's going to look like you've been assassinated. It's going to look like you're dead. And that's going to send panic across all of the stock markets and across the nation as a whole.
Yeah, I'd like to pick up something that Steve said about the media and getting back to basics. I think the most important thing the media could do right now is actually returning to facts and calling a lie a lie. Because at the moment, all they've done in a lot of cases is basically reported something Trump said without and just left out whether it's true or not out the headline. And unfortunately, a lot of people just read the headlines these days. Mm. I mean, a classic case this week was where Trump tweeted something bragging about how the chairman of Ford had told him that this plant in Lincoln wasn't moving to Mexico. Meanwhile, it was never actually going to move. Trump was basically using that as a way to try and take credit for keeping jobs in the US, when in fact that really wasn't the case. Given how often, you know, and just, Trump lies and just how dishonest he is, that's going to set a very dangerous precedent for the next few years if the media doesn't sort of sharpen up on that.
Yeah, we didn't really talk about the media in last week's show, but I think you can see in the presidential election something that happened in the British press here over the EU referendum, where you kind of get the postmodern normalisation of bullshit, perhaps. Where,
yeah, the post-fact era, as it's called.
Sort of, well, I prefer golden age of political bullshit. I don't like, because basically it ends up being their lies versus our lies in mm-hmm. the case of the EU referendum. In the US, it became Hillary's scandal against Donald's scandal, and they became equated as being the same when they really, really weren't. People like Barack Obama, people like Hillary Clinton, they've said some good things about trying to get a peaceful transition in. So Obama said, we're all rooting for Donald Trump's success in uniting and leading the country. And I'm guessing one of the reasons they're doing that is because one of the worst things that Trump said in the debates was his refusal to accept the result come what may. And that kind of violation of democratic norms. But they have to, especially after what he's just said, they have to be quite clear and say, yeah, you won, fine, we're not going to whinge about it, you're going to be president in January.
Yeah.
God help us.
Yeah. And also, I think it's one of the cornerstones of any functioning democracy is the peaceful transfer of power. And I think that, above all, is why Obama, especially being the outgoing president, it's basically his duty to ensure that that happens. So whatever he personally thinks of Trump, and I have absolutely no doubt that he has he yeah. shares our opinion of him, that he has to be seen to be encouraging him, you know, which is why you're now seeing him in this sort of bizarre role of tutor, where he's having to basically coach Trump through the basics of the presidency, because neither he or his team were actually aware of the scope of the role, which is quite terrifying, and why we're currently broadcasting from a bunker.
Yeah. There's an article in the New Yorker trying to say that Trump's transition was being almost uniquely chaotic, but that doesn't quite seem the case. I mean, the transition between Reagan and the elder Bush was also quite chaotic and quite vicious, because a lot of people in that Reagan administration were losing their jobs, even though it was the same party coming in. So that was kind of quite bitter, quite
and
twisted.
And the current vice president as well, yeah.
Yeah. And the Clinton transition was also really chaotic, because you had people in Washington, you had people in Arkansas, they weren't communicating to each other. And Clinton's chief of staff was Thomas McCarthy, who was appointed. Now, he was a newbie, he had no Washington experience whatsoever, and he only lasted a couple of years. Reince Priebus seems okay. He was one of the people after 2012 who said the Republicans need to reach out to women and Latinos, and I mean, that went well.
I mean, Reince Priebus is the consummate professional insider for the Republican Party. So in that case, yeah, it's a pretty solid appointment. Although it's one of those questions where you kind of go, well, who else could it have been? The description of what Trump's going through is chaotic. As you said, it's not that necessarily unusual in terms of how fast appointments are happening and things like that, because the NPR politics team did a bit of an analysis, and they did a comparison where they looked at where Obama was and where Trump is now at the exact same points in their transition process. And the difference was like one or two positions. So it's not that unusual. The only difference is that this time, well, with Obama, you had hope, change, and look,
isn't this wonderful being the prevailing media message?
I think change is definitely a message. Yeah.
But this time, the narrative in the media is a much more negative one. Yeah. So they are much more like to latch on to chaos and confusion.
I think part of it as well is that currently the transition team are currently throwing out so many names. So, I mean, this week alone, we've had Rudy Giuliani and, Newt Gingrich, and then floated for Secretary of State. And then
John Bolton.
John Bolton as well. Yeah, so we've had all these names, and it's causing a lot of panic, especially when you consider the prospect of John Bolton as Secretary of State, basically causing people to panic when they're seeing these names, which I think is basically contributing to this idea that Trump's transition is in chaos at the moment.
Yeah, and I think that may very well be an instance where the lack of political experience of the Trump campaign is actually bleeding through. Trump likes having warring factions, because it gets, in some ways, it kind of makes sense, because you get to hear two very different opinions, and then you get to make the call, which is good for if you want to maintain your power base. Is when you have factions, you will always have kind of a power play and a tussling, which means things will get leaked, things will get put out, there will be anonymous briefing and sourcing against both sides by various different people. And I think that's probably what we're seeing here. It's not unusual necessarily that all of those people's names would have come up in a discussion. The only difference is someone's then gone and said, and either tweeted it out openly, which you shouldn't be doing, or they've leaked it to the press because they're just like, well, if we can kick up enough backlash about John Bolton getting it, maybe we don't get John Bolton.
Can we talk a bit about Steve Bannon, though? Because there's been lots of stuff about saying that he's a white nationalist, that he's a neo-Nazi. What's your opinion on Steve Bannon? Is he a nationalist? Is it just that he gives platforms for hateful, clickbaity articles on how... what was one of them? Would you rather your daughter had cancer or feminism?
Oh, yeah, very charming. But to be honest, I think people tend to look at it the wrong way. People should actually look at the impact of someone's actions rather than whether they are something or not. The fact that he is giving a platform to bigotry, and he has, when he was in charge of Breitbart, he oversaw several anti-Semitic pieces, especially an attack on Bill Kristol as a renegade Jew. When you're actually allowing things like that to happen, you may as well be one yourself, because you're basically, you're giving it a voice, you're empowering it. He's certainly a nationalist, which, as you said earlier, which that's probably explains some of his comments. His comments this week, or what was it, on Asian CEOs in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, there was something about how there's too many Asian CEOs.
I'd
say that's a pretty accurate description. I'm not sure this guy is a neo-Nazi. I think he's definitely a nationalist. At the very least, he's a very reckless individual if he's allowed the sorts of articles that have appeared on Breitbart. Breitbart's US wing to appear. I think we're going to have with Bannon what we had with Dick Cheney under Bush. He becomes this almost malevolent figure who everybody knows is just pulling all of the strings out of it. But in reality, Cheney wasn't necessarily that much. Karl Rove wasn't even that bad.
There was a tweet from a Republican I saw this week that says Trump and Bannon will have their conspiracy talk, and it'll be Priebus that makes the trains run on time. Is that a fair summation?
Maybe.
A scarier figure as I find Bannon, I think we've probably got more to fear from the actual cabinet appointees and the actual people who will have actual power to, especially what we're looking at with regards to, say, Jeff Sessions, who's Trump's nominee for Attorney General. This is a guy who was considered 30 years ago to be far too racist to be a federal judge, but now Trump seems to think he's a fine pick for Attorney General.
And the other main appointment this week is Mike Flynn, isn't it? Who I think is his national security advisor, who said some quite dodgy things about Islam.
I think with Flynn there's a whole host of things you can kind of pick into, such as his stance on torture, which he thinks is A-okay regardless of situation. He has deemed Islam to be just
irrational.
Like,
I think.
Just the whole thing. He doesn't differentiate between, say, radical extremist Islam and, you know, Islam the religion. He just thinks Islam as a whole is something to be feared, which is quite worrying when you've got someone who's in charge of, who's going to be the national security advisor. And there's questions about his temperament as well. If you've seen him on Twitter, he's regularly tweeted things which clearly aren't true. He's spread certain false stories about stuff, and he doesn't bother to check any of this. People, his colleagues, used to refer to some of the facts he came up with as Flynn facts, as in he was basically making stuff up.
He'll fit right in then to the Trump White House.
Pretty much, yes.
What do we think of Trump's tweeting? How... It just... The petty kind of talk, whinging about the New York Times and making stuff up. And
it's basically Nixon on steroids, isn't it?
Yeah. If, I suppose if Nixon had Twitter.
It's basically, if Richard Nixon had Twitter, yeah, that's basically what you would see, I think.
Nixon had Twitter, he wouldn't need to actually have bugged Watergate. So the entirety of the Democratic Party would have just tweeted out their strategy.
It's going to be interesting seeing what becomes of the official POTUS Twitter account when the keys are handed over to
I pity that poor intern. I really do. Yeah. I think before we move on to realignment of the left then, please do subscribe to us on iTunes. Please do leave us a review. That helps buy more tinned food for the nuclear bunker in which we are now living in. And if you could leave a review, it really does help people discover the show. If you want to tweet us afterwards with any hints, tips, casual abuse, I'm at Paperback Rioter.
I'm at Centre Radical.
I'm at Abracadabra.
If you want to spell that one.
That's for the 20 minutes this moment. In Britain, certainly, there's been some talk, as there usually is every few years, about trying to have a progressive alliance, by which usually we mean an anti-Tory alliance. So there was a book published by Bite Back called The Alternative, which had Green politicians, Lib Dem politicians and Labour politicians talking about how progressives could come together and causes that they could come together. Paddy Ashdown has talked about the need to realign the progressives in the centre in all kind of three main parties, and he started the crowdfunding thing called More United, which is meant to be a kind of cross party, and it's supported by people like Dan Snow and Simon Sharma, the usual suspects.
Yeah.
I suppose
take a view of who supported the alternative vote in the AV referendum, and you've probably got the same list of people.
We probably know them all personally.
Yeah, moving behind...
There's a by-election in Richmond, which we haven't talked about on the podcast, but it's happening because Zach Goldsmith is an egotistic... I mean, because Zach Goldsmith said that he'd step down if the third runway at Heathrow was approved. Yeah. And there was some talk, there was an article by Clive Lewis, who we've talked about as a possible Labour leader, John Reynolds and Lisa Nandy as well, saying that Labour should not field a candidate in that by-election and instead support the Lib Dems. That was quickly poo-pooed, and in fact Labour's candidate is Christian Wolmar, which I think is quite a good choice. He's kind of campaigned a lot on transport in London, I think ran as an independent mayor of London, but most of the reaction from Labour figures has been quite hostile. I think Luke Akehurst, who's I think one of the standard bearers of the kind of centrists in the Labour Party, said that any kind of talk of a progressive alliance is always born out of the despair that Labour can win, rather than kind of being about any common ground or any ideas. I mean, do you think we are going to see parties working a bit more together over the next few years?
I think we are, because I don't think it's too much out of despair that Labour can win, but I think that the Labour Party at the moment is so fractured that I think an actual alliance between different parties is the only way you're going to get like a moderate sort of left party in government again. Given the likely outcome of the 2020 election, it's probably best to reduce the Tory gains as much as possible through sort of helping the other parties out, like in this by-election, for instance. So it would be definitely a gain to try and one less Tory MP going forward than trying to just going for a vain attempt to try and win an election, which you're clearly not going to do.
Well, I think you're right. I think one of the reasons you're right, and what people like Luke Akehurst and a lot of the kind of Labour tribalists miss, is that one of the reasons why Labour got so many seats in 1997 and one of the reasons the Tories were so wiped out in 1997 is because there was a very much, people were voting anti-Tory, so people voted for the Labour candidate or voted for the Lib Dem candidate who were best placed to defeat the Tories in that area. And I think when people kind of poo-poo the idea of a progressive alliance, they forget that actually that's one of the main reasons why Labour had such a big majority in the 90s anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I just can't see it happening. I can't see that any actual real kind of cooperation actually occurring. And I say this as someone who used to be a member of the Lib Dems and has seen what the opinion of most what Lib Dem opinion is on an awful lot of Labour MPs. And it's not positive at all. The people that we around this table may sit down and go, actually, you know, they're moderate, they're reasonable, whatever, that they will be disparaged in a very similar way to the way the Corbynites do as Blairites. There is not necessarily that much love to lose between significant parts of the Lib Dems and Labour. The view is that Labour are authoritarian bastards who are going to screw everything up at the first opportunity they get.
I think conversely, on the Labour side, a lot of Labour members see the Lib Dems as propping up a Tory coalition for 4 years very ill-advisedly.
Yeah. I mean, plus, what you also then have to deal with is the fact that neither of the particular of the leaderships are going to be able to work together. Corbyn's not going to be able to work with Farron for the most part because they just disagree on an awful lot of things. And without that cooperation at the leadership level, you're going to have an issue. And even if you did get that cooperation, well, an awful lot of Lib Dems remember what happened with Paddy Ashdown and Tony Blair, where it was like, oh yeah, we could go into government with Tony Blair, it would all be wonderful, Liberals would be in government, we'd be able to restrain some of Labour's excesses. No, the party did not want that, and the party did not have it, because they were worried about being subsumed by Labour. So many of the members and so many of the people who are sat on the committees that determine an awful lot of the direction that the Liberal Democrats take are going to be people who remember that, and they're not going to appreciate it if something like that happens again, especially when it's Corbyn, especially when it's someone that, even if they do kind of vaguely agree with him in the general direction of travel, they think he's incompetent.
Well, it's the problem that any sort of realignment isn't going to happen without electoral reform, because it's possible for the odd by-election that you can step candidates down in favour of a progressive candidate.
Yeah.
But if you're a Labour member in a Lib Dem Tory marginal, you might want to vote for that Labour candidate. You want to canvass for that Labour candidate. You don't necessarily just want to vote for the Lib Dem candidate to beat the Tories. Same with any of the Green candidates as well. People want to vote for the Greens. They're not necessarily going to vote for the anti-Tory candidate. And so it's kind of our electoral system which stops parties working together and stops any alliances, I think.
Also, I think it also sort of goes back to something that's wrong with a lot of politics these days, is that people are annoyed at having to vote against something rather than for something, and they're quite fed up with it, which I think is why you're seeing this sort of growing populist movement and why people are attracted to it, because they're seeing something that, hey, I can actually vote for this, rather than saying, okay, I just really don't like that party, so I'm just going to try and keep them out of office.
But is the problem almost with the realignment of the left is that there aren't many policies to vote for. Like, we kind of need that new vision for the left. It needs to come from somewhere. But at the moment, exactly what that would be, especially with the Labour leadership.
Yeah, I think that's probably the core thing, because we've talked about actually the realignment of the right, and you can see it in the US with Trump and his populism. You can see it with UKIP in the UK. You can see it with the Front National in France. It's not just new parties or whatever. It's new, I say new ideas. It's pushing other ideas to the forefront, which the left has not done. Part of the reason for that is because actually an awful lot of the things that the left has been fighting for so many years have, in terms of the economics of it all, which tends to be the left's bread and butter, have kind of already been won. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean they're safe. It doesn't mean they might still be at risk. But a lot of those battles have been won. So what they need to do is find a new kind of vision for things that they would want to do. And at the moment, all we're getting is, okay, we've got maybe we've got universal basic income. Maybe we've got, it's a living wage rather than a minimum wage. But those things, for most people, aren't necessarily that attention-grabbing. And they're very technocratic. And they're not. And in an age where political identity and the identity of the individual is becoming more and more important, those kind of policies aren't going to wash and grab the attention.
Yeah, I think messaging's a big problem. I think a lot of what's going on in the US and in here is I think the left is just failing to sell liberalism, and sort of assumes that people are bound to agree. Well, no, our policies are sort of inherently right. Therefore, everyone with any sense is bound to agree with it, and so they get which results in complacency. And I think that's part of why there's been a few setbacks for the left recently. It's because we're not actually making the argument for leftist policies at all.
Yeah, there was there's a bloke on like Facebook whose videos appear in my feed every now and again called Jonathan Pye, who 90% of the time I can't fucking stand. I find him to be a shouty, arrogant arsehole.
That's one less guest we're going to have on the podcast.
I know. I'm so heartbroken by this. But after the Trump's election victory, he did put out a video which was, I think, was quite spot on, where he basically said the left has forgotten how to debate. It's forgotten how to argue.
Yeah.
Rather than
analyse the situation and say, how can we do better? The left jumps into it and says, oh, if you voted for Brexit, you're a racist. If you voted for Trump, you're a racist. And it's like, no, that's not necessarily true. Yes, it opens up a whole can of worms that you value your economic security for whatever, a bit more than basic rights for these individuals or these types of individuals. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily make them a racist. And I do feel that, as a whole, the left has just gotten into this knee-jerk reaction where if somebody says something bad that they disagree with, oh, you're a bigot. You know, disagreement on economic lines, it's not because you just disagree and you've got a better, and they've got a different idea about how to get to point B. It's because they're evil and it's because they're trying to destroy the welfare state or whatever. It's like, I do not have a lot of time for Ian Duncan Smith in a lot of ways, but genuinely, he's come out since actually leaving government and been very much more kind of saying, yeah, these cuts should be reversed, and has made calls for the Theresa May's government to reverse a number of the cuts that he was forced to make because of George Osborne. Now, that narrative doesn't necessarily align with the portrayal of IDS as the SS hat wearing Nazi that literally does the rounds on Facebook. But it's a classic example of people of the left just treating someone as the enemy rather than as an individual.
It's not just a case of just sort of just shutting down arguments by calling people names, saying you're a bigot or whatever. I mean, a disturbing trend we're seeing on university campuses these days is just trying to actually ban any sort of dissenting views, yeah, or no platform people who've got, you know, particularly sort of strong opinions that that liberal students don't agree with. I mean, this week you had students at the University of London, I think it was, tried to have the Sun, the Express and the Daily Mail newspapers banned from campus. And, you know, that's just bad on so many levels. If you can't actually handle sort of, I mean,
you can't even handle having the alternate opinions put in front of you, how the hell are you even going to persuade anyone?
Yeah, I mean, these kids are going to be in for a real shock when they actually go into the real world and find that you can't just, you know, sort of block out all opposing reviews, no matter how much you disagree with them or how personally repugnant you find them. The problem with this is that's probably what's causing a lot of the liberal inability to argue, because it's easier to just shut everything away. And this is the kind of thing we used to criticise the right for, that they would lock themselves in their own bubble with Fox News or their own, what was it, epistemic closure, I think it was yeah, termed. Meanwhile, we're basically guilty of the same thing. Well, the left is guilty of a lot of the same things these days.
I've just started rereading The Political Brain by Drew Weston, and I think that's still as relevant today as it was when it was written a dozen years ago, because his main argument essentially is that human beings make decisions based on emotion rather than rationality, and the problem with the democratic message over the past 20, 30 years has been, yeah, they don't tell stories, they don't tell a convincing narrative about what's wrong with America and how they can fix it. Instead, it tends to be very rational, based on the facts, and that doesn't attract people. And you've seen that with the Brexit, which we've talked a lot about in our political bullshit discussions. But, I mean, welfare is an excellent example as well. Rather than telling a story about these people who need help, instead it tends to be a very dry discussion about facts, and it tends to be more, well, this much is lost in tax avoidance, this much is lost, you know, this much of the welfare budget is on benefit fraud, it isn't really that much about. And that misses the point. The point is that you need to have a narrative of why welfare spending is useful and why it is a good thing, and that just is not there. And it's interesting, I mean, we've been in the pub, from the quality of this, we were in the pub watching the football before we started recording this, and one of the things we talked about is Labour Party's screening I Daniel Blake on Thursday, and, you know, wondering that it used to be nice that the Labour Party was a party of government rather than one that just promoted Ken Loach films. But I think there is a case for having something like I Daniel Blake does tell a good story about the benefit system that supports a Labour argument. The problem is it's just not being made well enough, and that's the kind of argument that needs to be made. It's just we're just saying watch a Ken Loach film, which is not going to play on the doorstep. No, yeah, if I knock on somewhere in Wheelie Castle and I say, well, yes, you might think welfare's a problem, but have you seen this new Ken Loach film? They're going to punch me in the face.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think welfare is a good thing. I'm not going to bloody well watch a fucking Ken Loach film. I can't stand Ken Loach. I don't even think he's that good a director either.
Another less guest. We're dropping that round table Jonathan Pye and Ken Loach is going to be a very awkward conversation.
Yeah. I'm just not going to be there for that episode.
Yeah, but it goes back to what we were saying. It's such a very insular approach. It's basically it's preaching to the choir in the worst sort of way. So the only people who are going to watch that sort of film, who are going to like join Labour at screenings, is going to be the people that already agree with Labour. It's not going to be the people that actually need to be convinced of the merits of the welfare state.
Yeah, floating voter cinema screenings coming to a cine world near you. On that note, I think we'll leave it there. Next week, 2 weeks after the first non-politician, non-soldier to be in the White House, we're going to be talking about how underappreciated politicians are. We do have a morbid sense of timing. We'll speak to you then. Bye-bye.